Dr. Michael Sala is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics. He is the author of Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence. Now, in addition, he has authored four other books, more than 70 articles, chapters, book reviews on peace, ethnic conflict, and conflict resolution. Dr. Sala is currently a researcher in residence in the Center for Global Peace at the American University. He has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland, Australia, and has an MA in philosophy from the University of Melbourne, also in Australia, of course. Dr. Sala's website, www.exopolitics.org, linked up, by the way, coasttocoastam.com, has to date scored almost 3 million hits and continues to attract great interest from those seeking to understand the big picture about the undisclosed extraterrestrial presence and its political implications. Our guest tonight on Coast to Coast, Dr. Michael Sala. Michael, welcome back. How are you?
Wonderful. Thanks, George. Thanks for having me back.
My pleasure. A lot of people fast-blasting me right now saying, George, please have him explain what exopolitics means. So I'll let you do that. What is it?
Well, very briefly, it's the study of the main actors, institutions, and processes concerning an extraterrestrial presence on Earth.
Now, you are a pioneer in this field. Take us back a few years, Michael, when you started getting involved in this. I mean, here you are. You are an expert in global peace. You're degreed quite heavily. How did you get involved in UFOs, the study of extraterrestrials, all of a sudden?
Well, as I've said in the past, my interest has been and continues to be international conflict. And so in understanding international conflict, I began to look at some of the kind of more exotic theories concerning what may be driving international conflict, and then I came across Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project and the 2001 press conference that he did, and what I saw was not so much the kind of UFO phenomenon as a kind of lights in the sky, let's prove that this is really going on phenomenon. What I saw was a political process covering up an extraterrestrial presence which had great implication for the way international politics was conducted. And so as I began to do more research into that, I realized that, in fact, yes, there was a great cover-up, and that there was a hidden infrastructure to deal with that, which consumed vast resources. And, of course, there's a lot of political capital that goes into covering this up. So the whole thing came out of an understanding that covering up the UFO phenomenon involved incredible political implications that just needed to be looked at if anyone was to really understand what was going on in the international arena.
If you were to grade them, Michael, on their ability to cover this up, how would you grade them?
Well, I think they've done an incredible job in just keeping this out of the mainstream public arena. In other words, the sort of news that most people consider to be what is going on in the international arena has been really well sanitized of the whole extraterrestrial phenomena. So then one has to get out of the kind of mainstream shows that air at the kind of peak viewing hours, and you go into the alternative media, and I'm not sure if you'd want to classify Coast to Coast as part of that alternative media, but that's really where you do get the discussion about the ET presence happening. So they've done a really good job in sanitizing the mainstream media.
By keeping it under wraps, to me, you would also need then the cooperation of the various alien races, or they themselves would try to make themselves known very easily. So am I right in that thought?
Well, there has been varying degrees of support on the part of different ET races, but certainly there have been some that have benefited greatly from the secrecy and I think have a vested interest in the secrecy continuing. And there have been others that have been trying to overcome the secrecy and been part of an extensive worldwide UFO phenomenon where there have been quite a number of sightings and also contacts. Individuals who have had face-to-face meetings. So we have both sides, ETs supporting and also not supporting this disclosure.
Michael, a debunker would say that we haven't even been visited by one extraterrestrial race, let alone 57. You talk about 57. How were you able to, I guess, catalog 57 different extraterrestrial races?
Well, one has to begin, I believe, with those who have had some direct experience with the ET phenomenon. And I think that probably the one source that does get a lot of attention are the whistleblowers, people who have participated in military intelligence projects that have had some direct interface with ETs. And there are a number of people that I actually do referred to in the study that have had this kind of direct interface. For example, Clifford Stone served in the U.S. Army for 22 years and actually participated in the recovery of UFOs and of the bodies, the personnel that were on these ships. And so he had direct experience with that. And of course, there were others who had that kind of direct experience in terms of the various documents that were part of the cover-up. For example, Sergeant Robert Dean, he served for 27 years in the U.S. Army and was also part of the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. And he part of his job was to brief the commander about the UFO presence and the various ETs to try to coordinate a proper NATO response.
Now tell me a little bit more about what they both specifically have said.
Sure. Well, as far as Clifford Stone is concerned, he had very extensive experience in retrieving craft that had crashed. His job was to be called at short notice from his normal army duties to participate in clandestine recovery efforts around the world. So it wasn't just in the U.S., but around the world. So he would be called to participate in these efforts. And he would have to go and sanitize the area, that is, make sure that all evidence pointing to an ET craft had being crashed had to be removed, that any witnesses had to be silenced or intimidated, and of course the craft itself had to be retrieved. He wasn't the only one that reported about these crashes. Colonel Steve Wilson was also another who participated in these crash retrievals. So both of them talked about their direct experience as army personnel in the location and the recovery of these crafts. So they saw what was going on, and part of their job was to make sure that this didn't get out into the mainstream arena.
Let's talk a little bit about the typology of the extraterrestrial races. Was this a study that you undertook? How did you begin to put the data together, Michael?
Well, it really did come out of my need to try and kind of make sense of the various descriptions that were made by a number of sources on who exactly is visiting here. I mean, comes across claims by different authors. Clifford Stone, for example, was the one that said that there were 57 different ET races visiting, and that was based on his personal experience.
And now when you say 57 different, you're talking about physically different, or are we talking about, I mean, because, you know, here on this planet, we could have one, you know, there's a number of different races on this planet, but we generally all look alike. These 57 extraterrestrial races that Clifford Stone is talking about, do they all look differently? I mean, are they some reptilians? Some look like dogs with brains? I mean, what are they?
Sure. Okay. Yes. Well, if one tried to do a kind of racial genotype of each of these species, you would come up with far fewer, probably 6 to 8 different genotypes, like the reptilian, the gray, the humanoid,
mm-hmm. The Nordiques,
so
yeah.
But in terms of different races, as far as their kind of stellar origins are concerned, there are 57. One can differentiate between human races that might come from a particular star system like the Pleiades, as opposed to another star system such as Procyon.
Okay, so we're talking about 57 races from 57 different spots and locations.
That's correct.
Okay. Okay. So, and again, let's get back to your report, your study. What was your methodology here? How did you begin to assemble?
Well, basically what I had to do was to look at what are the best sources of evidence for this. I had to begin by really looking at the different reports in terms of, well, is this a whistleblower report, which can be verified in terms of, well, this whistleblower served for X number of years in a military or intelligence organization or some other federal agency? Was this a contactee or an abductee report in terms of, well, was this someone who actually directly interfaced with an ET, spoke to them and entered their ships and was shown what world they came from or was given information from the ETs? Was this a report that came from historical records? Was it something that was telepathically communicated? I had to look at the different categories of evidence and identify, well, which ones of these different sources are the most credible. And so I finally settled for the whistleblower and the contactee reports, because in both cases you had people who had some direct physical interaction with ET races or witnessed documents, official documents that described the various races and what they were up to.
Are they coming merely from our galaxy, or are they coming from way out in the universe?
Primarily from the galaxy. Some do talk about extragalactic visitors and also interdimensional visitors. Certainly Robert Dean wanted to point out that it was certainly not just ETs from our galaxy, but one had to look at the interdimensional and the extra kind of galactic sources. But the main group of ETs and the kind of councils that are supposed to be involved with regulating these various races on Earth are from our galaxy.
What kind of, I'm going to talk to you about craft, about intelligence, about get your thoughts on the length of time span that they have existed beyond us. But what about the craft first and foremost? How are they getting here?
Well, it seems that the ones that are visiting from the galaxy itself, they use a variety of mechanisms for getting here. The main source is are these large motherships that are described by a number of sources. The size itself is a bit difficult to pinpoint, but you know, there have been witness sightings of very large motherships, like the cigar-type motherships that are several kilometers in length.
Yeah, so just immense, right?
Exactly, something vastly bigger than an aircraft carrier. And then there are the kind of pods or beam ships that come out of these motherships that are the ones that most contactees report when they have their own experiences or are taken up to see the main ET ships, or even to make some kind of interstellar travel, so that you have these smaller ships, and they come in a variety of sizes. The kind of photos that Billy Meyer produced of these circular craft that do look like flying saucers, two saucers stuck together, seem to be the predominant shape for these beam ships or these pods that visit.
What about propulsion?
Oh, that's an interesting one. There seems to be some kind of anti-gravity mechanism that is used for traveling around the planet Earth itself. But in terms of the interstellar travel, there are references to this ability to be able to bend time and space.
Ah.
Some kind of warp drive that the Star Trek series kind of fictionalized.
So that's almost instantaneously then. Just, they bend it and they go from point A to point B within seconds, I would guess.
That's right, yes. I think that the main time spent in making these kinds of journeys, for example, the Pleiadians that Billy Meyer worked with described how the time it took for them to get from their world, Terra, in the Pleiadian system. Really, the main time was in the slowing down from exiting this kind of interstellar hyperspace drive and navigating through the planets in the orbit of the Sun. So they would presumably get into this hyperspace drive out when they are outside of their own solar system, enter the vicinity of our solar system through this hyperspace drive, then they'd come out and then they would use some kind of anti-gravity propulsion system to be able to navigate the rest of the way to the Earth.
So they may come up, let's say, around Jupiter or something like that?
That's right, yes. Some place where there isn't the kind of concentrated planetary movements.
Michael, in terms of that, do they talk about them being time travelers?
Yes, definitely. The time travel phenomenon is extensively used by these different races, and so it makes it very difficult to actually pinpoint where they come from, because it may involve a different time and space. So, for example, they might describe themselves as coming from the Pleiadian star system, but it may be in a time which might be, say, 300 years in the future. And so that makes it a little difficult in actually understanding how we have a phenomenon of ET visitors, but they might come from different places in the galaxy, but also different time regions in the galaxy. So, for example, if we went to Terra now in the Pleiadian star constellation,
mm-hmm.
we might find that, well, at the moment there's nothing on Terra, but in say 500 years time we have a flourishing civilization. That kind of phenomenon.
Why here? What are they coming here for?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? Why here? Why Earth, given that we are in a relatively primitive state and they have this advanced technology? I think what would be very indicative of an answer is the great number of races that are interacting in some way with the Earth, 57 or more directly interacting or monitoring the Earth. I think that what that would indicate is that there's some kind of synchronicity or some kind of relationship which might involve some genetic link with these different ET races.
Maybe a universal federation, Michael. You know?
Well, yes, some sort of federation, some kind of association of worlds, probably different groups of associations, similar to how we have different associations on the planet, like the Arab League, the African Union, the European
Union. The United Nations.
Exactly.
Like
so we have a number of different regional and planetary organizations, so it wouldn't be, I think, wrong to suggest that the ETs have similar types of organizations. And that they are visiting Earth because they have some genetic connection with the different human races.
Maybe they help jumpstart us.
Definitely. I think one looks at the Zechariah Sitchin material and sees here an example of how the Sumerians describe the Anunnaki as having played a role in the beginning of the human race. And in genetically upgrading a more primitive species, such as Neanderthal, into Homo sapiens. So this has happened not just with the Anunnaki, but I believe the evidence suggests that, well, this has happened a great number of times.
Well, Michael, when we come back, I want to ask you if they're all friendly. And, of course, one of the debunkers' criticisms always is, what about the evidence? So we'll talk a little bit about that when we come back as well. Our guest tonight, Dr. Michael Sala. You're listening to Coast AM. Michael, these various races, and we're going to get into the 57, and then you've concentrated on a certain number of them, but are they all friendly, or do we have some problems here?
Well, I certainly think that that's really the key question here, George. What is a friendly ET and what is an unfriendly ET? It's a really difficult question because I think that on the surface one can say, well, we can say certain ETs are unfriendly because they do things such as abductions and kind of co-opt particular leaders and officials in various agencies or government organizations. But then one can look at, well, these ETs might simply respond, well, what we've done is we've just entered into agreements with your government authorities, and that as a consequence of these agreements, we've been able to conduct certain experiments with our civilians. And so they might say, well, as a result of that, we've been able to kind of like genetically upgrade certain numbers of individuals, improve their psychic and telepathic abilities, make them more aware of the need to deal with environmental problems and so forth. So a race might simply say that, yes, well, it certainly appears to be unfriendly because we do these invasive procedures after we've abducted civilians without their permission. But then when you look at the result, what you have is individuals who have a higher consciousness, more telepathically gifted and psychically equipped. And so they might say, well, this indicates that we are acting in the best interest of the species. But I think when one considers those kinds of justifications and looks at the great number of ETs interacting and their behaviours, I think we can say that, well, some are friendly because of the whole scope of their activities, and some are unfriendly, or certainly we can be suspicious of them given the whole scope of their activities.
How long have they been coming to this planet, since the beginning of time?
Well, yes, I think certainly from the very beginning of the human presence on the planet. I don't think that there's any real doubt when one looks at the overall evidence that humans were bioengineered, so that in terms of the human presence on the planet, the ET presence has been from the very beginning of the human presence. So we're talking hundreds of thousands of years, if not millions of years.
And, Michael, let me ask you this. One of the things debunkers will always say, where's the evidence? You know, you might have some indentations, but, you know, that could have been made. You know, we don't have, in terms of seeing, now maybe governments do, where's the craft? Where's the pieces? Where do we have here? You know, years ago somebody gave art some things that were called art's parts that were analyzed and indeed showed some strange anomalies in the metal. But where is the evidence?
Well, the best evidence, I think, are the whistleblower testimonies about what is actually going on in the various compartmentalized projects that are located throughout the U.S. And so when one looks at the inability of various congressional oversight committees to find out what's happening in these projects after their different constituents have asked them to look into it, then one sees that, well, there's evidence of compartmentalized projects that there is top secrecy over, even above top secret security classifications given to these, where there are provisions in place to punish whistleblowers from the military intelligence community who discuss the ET presence. So you look at such things as the laws in place. For example, there's the Joint Army-Navy Air Publication 146 that was passed in 1953-54 that actually makes it an offence for military officials to disclose information about the ET presence. 10 years imprisonment and $10,000 fine back in 53-54. So we're talking about a system that has been put in place that precludes the evidence, the physical evidence, from coming into the public arena, because any official that discloses this is immediately going to be arrested for breaking 146. So when one looks at that kind of skeptical or debunker claim, well, where's the evidence? One has to say, well, look, here's a system set up to preclude that. So, and here's the evidence of that system, and you can refer to these laws. You can refer to JNEP 146. It's actually now been revealed after having been for many decades a state secret, and you can look at the whistleblowers and in terms of their testimonies of what they saw and did.
But in terms of strong evidence, what would you say would be the strongest evidence that we're being visited by not only 57, by at least one?
Sure. Well, the strongest evidence are the crashed discs. I mean, when you have a UFO that has actually crashed as a consequence of whatever environmental anomaly, or whether it's some kind of specific targeted, it's been targeted by some kind of technology, and you have these crashes, and you have military personnel cordoning off an area and actually making sure that all witnesses are intimidated into silence, and then they sanitize the area, remove all the evidence, and then you have whistleblowers coming forward later discussing what actually did happen, then I think you have very strong evidence that, yes, there is a process underway for sanitizing, hiding the ET phenomenon, and the 1947 Roswell crash is probably the best example, and there have been many others since that time.
Have you taken a stand on this Dan Burrish case? You've heard about it, I'm sure.
Well, definitely, yes. We did talk about it some time ago, and I think that he is who he claims to be, a participant in one of these clandestine projects. But, I mean, there's a lot surrounding how he's able to get his information out into the public and what the agendas are behind that.
I've asked him through Linda Moulton Howe to take a lie detector test, and I don't think it is going to happen.
Well, yes, that's a shame that he's not going to come out into the open. But I
mean, would that offend you if you made a claim like he has, and you know, a legitimate media source says, okay, just would you take this lie detector test? We're going to pay for it. As a matter of fact, UFO Magazine and Coast to Coast will do it jointly. I mean, would you be offended? I would do it. You know, I would say, look, I'm gonna back up my claims, and if you don't believe me, here's one way that I'm gonna try to prove it to you.
Well, yeah, I think he would understand that that's a legitimate request, because there is a skeptical public out there, and a lie detector is one way to satisfy that kind of skepticism. So I'm sure he could understand why there would be a need. Or why that would be a legitimate request. As to why he didn't do it, well, I guess he has his own reasons for that. I haven't read fully what exactly mm-hmm. are those reasons, but I think it's legitimate to make that kind of request.
Now, of these 57 different races, you concentrate on about 17 of them, Michael. Why is that?
Well, I looked at what is the difference between those races that are interacting directly with the human population, as opposed to those that are primarily here in an observer capacity, just to monitor the Earth and what's happening here. We're kind of like a big show in a way.
All right, and give me your definition of interacting with the human population.
Interacting either through an agreement with the government,
okay,
or through contacts with civilians. In terms of actually having civilians taken on board these ships.
So abductions?
Abductions would definitely be a form of interaction.
Okay.
So, yes, anything that actually is more than just observing, something like just watching a big kind of planetary show from some distance and not doing anything more than just watching.
Who are those 17 ET races?
Well, that is what I've done most work on in terms of this report that just came out, and there are some tables that I notice are on your website just outlining these different races. I divide them on the basis of those races that have made some direct connection with the government through a series of agreements, and those races that chose to stay outside of these agreements. So that was the main way of differentiating between the different races.
And let me read just a few of them for us, Michael, and then we'll come back to them. Short grays, okay?
Yes.
Tall grays, reptilians, draconian reptilians, Syrians, and I don't mean those from the country of Syria by any means, the Anunnaki. And let me continue. The Talosians, which are earthbound, you say, right?
Yes, that's correct. Subterranean.
Lyrians, Pleiadians, Procons, and get up to the coasttocoastam.com website, those of you who have a computer. Tassetians, Andromedians, Sirians is from Sirius A, the two-star system, of course. Alpha Centurions, Amites. You've done great homework here, Michael, in at least breaking down the races, their main activities, and I'll tell you what's also fascinating. You say that most of them are assisting in global solutions right now. How are they interacting in that regard?
Well, yes, that's right. I think that the majority of these races are helping with the solution of a whole series of global problems, and they're helping through a number of ways. They're helping through some direct interaction with humans in terms of giving or releasing information. For example, the Umayyads, they were established in Spain and France during the right from the 1950s up until later, the 1980s was when they supposedly left. And during this time, they released a lot of information, scientific information, technical information that was dispersed through various European UFO organizations to the general public and to scientific institutions. And this information had a lot of relevance in terms of new paradigms in scientific and technical thinking. So that was something that the Umayyads did. Other races, for example, the Andromedans, they are a race that the contactee Alex Collier has had most interaction with, and they pass on information concerning the kind of system that we have in place here and what exactly might be done to resolve the problem. So they release that information through a contactee like Alex Collier.
Do you believe Alex's stories?
Yes, I've actually interviewed Alex and had the chance to speak to some people who know of Alex, and to my mind, he is credible. I think he has been able to give a lot of information that is relevant. He was silenced. That was the thing that I found to be most fascinating, and also, in my mind, confirmed what I have detected in terms of contactees, that they are silenced. The big difference between the contactee community and the abductee community is that abductees talk about negative ETs and the horrible things or the disturbing things that happen.
Mm-hmm.
By and large, abductees are kind of not really treated or given special attention by the security agencies. But the contactees who talk about these positive ETs, these humans who basically look like us and the kind of wonderful technologies that they have, they are very severely repressed. Their information is really very dangerous to the system that has been set up because their information concerns positive ETs, ones who are here helping us. And Alex Collier did actually go through that and did divulge to me the process whereby he was basically silenced.
Are there some ETs on this planet who are here for not good purposes?
Definitely. There are some races that are here basically to harvest humanity for the various resources that we possess, and that they have been doing this for an extensive period of time. And I think a system has been set up whereby this can be done in an efficient way where humans are not by and large aware of this harvesting process, whereby our resources are basically taken away in a fashion that isn't noticeable to the general public, but is still very efficient and basically is done for the benefit of these ET races that have been doing this harvesting for centuries and decades, at least.
How can the other races stop them?
Well, the primary way of stopping this kind of negative interaction is by individual and collective groups of humans basically having an assent or having a clear intent as to who it is that they want to work with. If there's ignorance about the ET presence, I think that's a general sign that people basically don't want to know about ETs. And so that basically is a form of permission for negative ETs or those that don't respect human rights or the human free will to basically intervene and do whatever they like, because the argument is, well, the humans don't care. You know, they don't believe that ETs are real, so if they don't believe we're real, well, then we can go in and do what we like because they have shown that they are not really concerned about the ET presence. And so they're displaying an ignorance, and we can exploit that ignorance. And there are other ET groups that say, well, if humans at an individual or collective level have a clear intent to interact with ETs that are beneficial, well, then that will happen, and that is exactly the process, I think, that we need to look at here. As individuals have that clear intent, then they will draw into their, well, whether you call it an energy field or whether you call it a kind of national environment or arena, those ETs that can play a positive role.
Are some of these ETs grabbing human beings and just taking them off the face of the planet?
Definitely. I think the abductee witness reports...
And not bringing them back.
Okay. I believe that is occurring in a way that isn't noticeable. I think most abductees, by and large, have the kind of experience which you see in the abduction reports of being taken on board these ships, typically grey ships where the short, kind of 3 to 4 foot tall humanoid greys do these invasive medical procedures and genetic experiments, and also show them the products of those genetic experiments, like these hybrid children. Most of those abductees are returned without any great harm other than the kind of trauma associated with an abduction and invasive medical procedures. But there are reports of humans being taken off the planet for much longer periods and basically harvested.
All right. We'll be right back with you, Michael. I want to check in with you and see if you've seen the USA show, the 4400, where they were taken and then brought back, and see if that is indeed happening as well then. Michael, did you see the USA show called 4400 by any chance?
I didn't see it. I do know of it, but not something that I've been able to look at.
I guess, because you alluded to this, that some humans have been taken and then brought back. In this particular program, in some cases, we're talking about years and years and years where they were taken. Is that possible?
As far as I know, the most that any kind of abductee, contactee has discussed their absence has been for a few months, and that they have been returned with only a few days or even hours having elapsed in Earth time. But I haven't heard anything about years having elapsed, so I don't know where they got that information from.
Well, maybe it's just good television, huh?
Might just be good television, and probably something that appeals to a lot of people.
The reptilian race, a lot of people, just because of the nature of what these creatures look like, believe that they're not very friendly. How many different kinds that I just saw on the website?
Well, I think the main difference that needs to be kept in mind is that there is a race of reptilians, according to the different sources of evidence that I've been able to find, that are indigenous to Earth, or at least have been here for as long as the human presence, or we're talking thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. So they might be viewed to be basically a human indigenous reptilian race that by and large is hidden, that they've been able to use whatever technology and advanced psychic abilities that they have to keep themselves kind of like out of the public eye, but they still play an important role in the background.
They've been able to shape-shift into human beings, perhaps?
Well, that's an interesting process. I mean, the way it's described is that it's not so much that they physically shapeshift, it's that they're able to impose in the human mind a physical human form, so that what is in reality a reptilian, if you took a photo, what would show a reptilian, that in fact what a human actually sees is a human. But that's because the reptilian, through their enhanced psychic abilities, are able to impose this image on the human race.
So David Icke believes that these reptilians are running governments.
I think that they definitely have a big role in how our governments are run and in the elites that run the system. I don't know about his claim that you actually have reptilians themselves with these shape-shifting abilities who are the top leaders. I mean, the kind of idea that, you know, President Clinton can kind of shape-shift into a reptilian. I mean, that's something that I'm probably a bit more skeptical of, but I think that there is a reptilian influence on the senior leaders.
Where are all these extraterrestrials, Michael? I mean, are they on the planet right now? Are they hiding underground? Are they in their ships above the planet? Where the heck are they?
I think all of those things, and also different kind of phases or dimensional spaces, if you might use that term, so that, for example, there are many sightings where you have this phenomenon of a ship suddenly disappearing. I think that what's happened is that ship has just moved into a different phase, a different kind of type of dimension, if you like. And so it really is a combination of all of those things that these races that are visiting the Earth or that are interacting with humanity or are hidden under the planet's surface may be in the same kind of time and space realm as us, or might be at certain times different in different dimensions. So I think it's a combination of all of those.
What's going on in New Mexico, Michael?
Well, in New Mexico there is a base called Dulce, which is something that was commented on in the beginning of the 1980s. There was a whistleblower, he wasn't a whistleblower, but certainly he was a very gifted telecommunications expert, Paul Benowitz, who began to release information in terms of electronic communications that he had received about this underground base in Dulce. And so he released that information, and so people began to take an interest in what was happening in Dulce. There were reports by whistleblowers of a military confrontation at Dulce in 1979, that there had been 66 elite Delta Force military personnel killed in a confrontation with some of the resident Greys at this base. That this base is a place where there are extensive violations of humans who have been forcibly taken into the base for a variety of experiments to be performed on them.
And this is underground?
That's right. This is all underground. That this base at Dulce is an underground base that is connected through a hub of high-speed rail connections to Area 51 and other locations throughout the U.S. and also throughout the planet. And interestingly, Dan Burrish said that he was taken to Dulce and asked to work there.
Right.
He actually overheard some of the experiments that were being conducted on the human humans trapped there.
Now, where's the opening for this base? I mean, can the public stumble into it by mistake?
Well, there are supposed to be openings in the vicinity that can be accessed. There have been investigators who have looked for these openings and haven't had any success. Why they haven't been successful? I guess it may be that these openings may be not used that extensively above Dulce, and that most of the way personnel are moved back and forth to Dulce is, as Dan Burrish described it, through adjacent underground bases such as Area 51, that he was taken on an underground shuttle from Area 51 or S4 to Dulce. So that may be the main means of transportation, so they may not actually need to use these access points in the vicinity of Dulce itself.
Are there ships, though, coming in and out of these things?
Definitely, yes. This is the phenomenon that Paul Benowitz, back in the early 1980s, was able to record, and he was able to release this information. And I believe there was a Japanese documentary made of this, showing some of these ships, and there are some photos that actually you can view on the internet of some of these ships entering into the Dulce facility.
this is incredible. I mean, what about witnesses in that area? What do they say? Do they see a lot of strange lights, objects coming and going?
Yes, well, there are witnesses of the UFO phenomenon in that area. That was something Paul Benowitz himself was able to confirm. There have been cattle mutilations as well, indicating that there was some extraordinary activity occurring in the area.
A lot of experimenting then.
That's right, yes. It seems that the Dulce facility is a very highly classified facility for conducting these experiments on humans, mind control, genetic experiments, even interdimensional experiments involving captive humans. I think this is something that the ETs there are cooperating with various national security agencies, the CIA, the NSA, in conducting these experiments so that they can all better understand the capacity of humans for doing these types of things. It seems that humans have a particular gift because we are supposed to be in an amalgam of up to 22 different extraterrestrial races.
Are there other countries involved with extraterrestrials? I mean, are the North Koreans, for example? And if they are, that means they must possess the same kind of technology that we have.
Well, I believe that there was some kind of exclusivity that was part of the agreements that the U.S. was able to sign with the ET races that are visiting, so that the U.S. is the primary nation for the ET agreements that are in place. But there are other facilities around the planet. In the UK, there are facilities. There is a facility in Australia, the Pine Gap facility, which is a joint underground base. There are collaborations with countries such as Russia in terms of the U.S. sharing this technology.
Some people say, by the way, that that Paul Benowitz might have been a disinformation officer. Did you ever hear that?
Well, he was certainly fed disinformation. There was the famous incident involving William Moore, who was a very prominent UFO researcher at the time, who told how he actually participated in a disinformation effort to get Paul Benowitz off the track at a 1989 MUFON conference. He actually described how he was encouraged by the Air Force Intelligence Organization to actually feed Benowitz disinformation, and he believed that he was very successful. But it was very interesting that he actually disclosed at a major UFO conference that was his one of his tasks, and that indicated that Paul Benowitz was actually revealing very sensitive information that the Air Force Office of Special Investigations was wanting to discredit.
What kind of agreements have been made between governments or shadow governments and the ETs?
Well, the agreements involve a variety of areas. Firstly, there's, from the perspective of the government, getting ET technology, which helps them understand how ETs are able to transport themselves through time and space. So, first of all, there are the ET ships, being able to understand those. And you've got examples like the recoveries of ships and the understanding of those that the ETs might provide. I think time travel is probably one of the big areas of cooperation. It seems that time travel abilities are somehow linked in with consciousness abilities. So what you have here is a strange alliance where ETs have the technical understanding of time travel, but humans possess the consciousness abilities to be able to effectively utilize time travel technologies. So it seems that some of the ET races cooperate with national security agencies because both bring into this cooperation things that the other lack. And it appears that such facilities such as Montauk on Long Island have been used for that, and that the NSA is very heavily involved in that whole phenomenon.
Now, the Anunnaki race that you talk about, this is fascinating. Is this the same race that Sitchin was talking about, the same Anunnaki?
That's right, yes. The Anunnaki that Sitchin talks about as having played a role in the genetic engineering of humanity. He talks about them as returning every 3,600 years on their homeworld of Nibiru.
Which would be in our solar system, he believes, right?
Yes, that's right. Yes, okay. He believes that it returns into our vicinity and that somehow this makes it possible for the Nibiruans or the Anunnaki to interact in a much more direct and immediate way with our humanity. So every 3,600 years, you would presumably have this kind of peak of Anunnaki activity. And we're supposedly entering into that now. Robert Dean, who has a lot of inside connections because, as you know, he's served in very sensitive positions during his 27 years. And he's confirmed that indeed the military intelligence communities are very concerned about what the Anunnaki are up to and what it means for them to be returning at this time into the normal course of human affairs.
Do they always wait 3,600 years, or, I mean, do they come and go as they please?
I believe that every 3,600 years you probably have a peak of Anunnaki activity, that somehow their home world of Nibiru enters into our solar system, which means that there's a maximum influence of any Anunnaki interaction. But during other times, I believe that there's probably some kind of small Anunnaki presence on the Earth itself. So presumably there may be a few Anunnaki here just to monitor things. And these may be, in fact, directly linked in with the elite families of Europe and the U.S., those elite families who control financial and political institutions, that these are linked in. We have references to the Illuminati, so I believe that that's probably where the Anunnaki presence is most strongly felt.
Because we look like them, we couldn't be able to distinguish ourselves from them, would we?
Well, they would be a kind of more genetically pure, if we use that term, human race, in terms of being connected to the original Anunnaki. So these human elites would be presumably having a genetic makeup that would reflect that kind of primary Anunnaki presence. So whatever Anunnaki are left here in a kind of supervisory capacity would presumably have this stronger genetic link to the Anunnaki themselves.
They wouldn't be all skull and bones members, would they?
That's a good question. One can look at a lot of these secret societies in the U.S. and in Europe and probably find at some point that there's some connection with either the Anunnaki or with the reptilians, who also have played an important role in how elite human organizations have been formed.
What kind of deals have been cut here?
Well, that's a good question, George. What is it that the human elites are looking for when they make deals with these different ET races? I guess, like in many different ages of human civilization, there have always been those who are interested in power and control and access to different resources, and probably the same motivations, that they're looking for those abilities to be able to control. And so the Anunnaki or the reptilians, whatever race is interested in controlling humans, are very interested in having a kind of human interface. Elite humans who would answer to these ETs in how the majority of humanity are controlled and manipulated for the benefit of the human elites and for the benefit of the ETs, who are kind of one step removed and in some way benefiting.
I've got a fast blast from Massachusetts, and she would like to know about any ETs that resemble insects. Are there any that look like that?
Yes, certainly. The praying mantis ETs are supposed to be very similar to the praying mantis insect, and they are supposed to be in the kind of 7 foot, 8 foot tall range, psychically very powerful, and supposedly even assist with some of the activities of the greys. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to find enough information on what it is that the praying mantis ETs are doing in terms of interacting with humans and with the secret government. So I basically put them into the kind of monitoring ET bracket rather than the ones directly interacting.
Michael, you're a researcher at the American University. You do this on your own time. You're not sanctioned by the university, but your belief in your work, does that ever create a problem in your other life?
Certainly it has. In fact, that there is a process that I'm presently underway where the program that I was previously running, the Peace Ambassador program, was terminated because of this ET work. And I think what really was the catalyst for that was a February 19 Washington Post article on the ET presence that really got the university.
Oh, that was the one about Eisenhauer.
That's right, yes. The university wasn't too impressed by that, and I think I was warned then, and now the program has been terminated.
I want to talk with you about that when we come right back, Michael, because you're putting your career on the line. Your income job was terminated, at least that program. Get a little bit more info from you when we come back. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Michael Sala. Michael, let's talk a little bit, if you're not uncomfortable about this, about what happened at the American University. I mean, is the entire project has been shut down? Are you no longer with them?
Well, that's basically what's happening now. The program that I was putting together, the Peace Ambassador program, was terminated back in May, soon after the X conference, and not too long after that Washington Post article on the Eisenhower ET meeting, and my affiliation with the university, I've been told and advised that that's not going to be renewed at the end of August, so then I officially will cease to be affiliated with the university, and that's all because of the exopolitics work that I've been doing.
Did they tell you that directly, or was that indirectly?
It was directly. Basically, I was told that the program was being influenced by this exopolitics research and that they found that to be unacceptable. I believe that was really just a spurious.
Incredible. What did they do, call you into an office? And I mean, how did they do that?
Well, it was just summarily done. I wasn't even told that they were considering this or asked to consult with them over their concerns. It was basically done summarily and done in a way that I think is very suspicious, that possibly there may have been some calls made or some communication to the director of the peace research, to the Center for Global Peace, that this was something that was not really favorable to the center.
Have you been able to garner any support because of this?
Well, at the moment, I'm appealing within the university system, so I'm finding that that takes quite some time, which is why there hasn't been any kind of public release of this information up until tonight. But basically, it's still in process. I'm appealing, and I think what will probably happen in the end is there'll probably be some ruling that set process wasn't followed, and that there's probably some compensation due to me, but that I believe that the program is finished and that my affiliation with the university basically won't be renewed unless there is some kind of intervention by the president of the university, which is President Benjamin Ladner.
How long were you at the university?
This is my eighth year there, so I've been there for quite some time.
8 years. 8 years, and you get involved in doing a little studying about possible extraterrestrial presence, and they decide it's time to get rid of Michael, right?
Basically, that's right, yes. So it was certainly a big shock to me that that they would do this after having served there for so long and in a number of capacities.
So do you want a little help from Coast to Coast listeners?
Well, I think any overtures by anyone interested to the university president, President Benjamin Ladner, any kind of letters of support for this type of research, I think that would help make him aware that this research is important for the public and that dismissing scholars because that they are pursuing this research is really not the sort of thing a progressive liberal university like American should be doing.
And this is the American University in Washington, D.C.
That's correct.
For people
yes.
who want to track down an email number of the president of the university. And let's turn yourself loose on this and help Michael, because, I mean, he has been a regular contributor here on Coast to Coast and presents some really fascinating information in the world of extraterrestrials. You might have remembered him. He was last on with me in March when we talked about extraterrestrial meeting with the then President Dwight Eisenhower many, many years ago. And here he is getting booted out of his job because he does some research on the side into something that he strongly believes in. Once again, a person is being muffled by doing some investigating into the UFO field. Now, some of you may think that none of this is true, that none of this is that it's not real. And a lot of you do. But my point is that when somebody goes out and tries to do a thorough job in doing some research, and then he's penalized, he's punished for that, I think that's that can't be tolerated. So why don't all of you, is there an email address or anything you can dig up for us, Michael, and maybe put on your website? Or would you rather people just call and find out themselves?
Well, certainly there's an email address. And I can tell you now or put it on my website.
Yeah, well, tell us now and put it on the website.
Okay. It's the address of the president of American University is simply Ladner, L-A-D-N-E-R.
L-A-D-M or N?
N.
Okay, L-A-D-N-E-R.
At American.
Okay.
.edu.
All right. L-A-D-N-E-R at American.edu.
That's correct.
And send them an email. Tell them how much we appreciate Michael Sala. And let's use the strength for a moment of Coast to Coast. I don't like to do this very often, but you know what? Darn it, this is not fair. And let's inundate this guy. Let's let him. Look, I get thousands of emails a day. I know what it's like to wake up in the morning, Michael, and look at all these emails from great Coast to Coast listeners. I want this president to wake up and look at his emails tomorrow morning. And right now it's coming up on 4 o'clock in the morning, Washington, D.C. time. And we got a strong affiliate there with WMAL. Let's let him wake up in the morning and see hundreds, if not thousands, of emails of people supporting what you do. And so let's turn it loose. And here's the email address one more time, ladner@american.edu. And let's at least see that an eight-year term. I mean, is that tenure out there at the university, 8 years?
Well, no. There's a tenure process, but I wasn't tenured. I was renewed on a year-to-year basis there.
All right, and our webmaster, Lex, will include your email information in the recap of the show that we put on the coasttocoastam.com website. And, Michael, just let me know what happens. I'm very curious to see if we can at least let this president know that you're not a wacko, that you're doing a thorough job in investigating something that needs to be investigating, and that I'm sure you're doing a thorough job doing what you do for the American University.
Yes, thanks, George. That really does help. I mean, it's really just bringing to the attention of the top university official that this is important research, that there's a lot of public interest in it, and it should be supported in some way at the university level. Otherwise, who's going to be doing the kind of thorough studies on this whole phenomenon if university researchers are intimidated and booted out because they want to pursue this in a serious way?
Who funds the university, Michael?
It's a private university, so students pay full fees, quite expensive. So.
Because I also know they're all over the Middle East. There's an American university in Beirut. A friend of mine, by the way, used to be the ambassador to the Arab League in the United Nations. He's been on my show before talking about Iraq. Dr. Clovis Maksoud teaches out at the American University in D.C. I don't know if you've ever crossed paths with him.
Oh, yes. I was a colleague with Dr. Maksoud, and we actually taught in the same department.
Wonderful individual. Yes. Absolutely wonderful person. And, you know, so let's do it, folks. Send your email. Send them tonight at Ladner, L-A-D-N-E-R, at American.edu. And be very polite about it, but, you know, talk about the fact that, you know, Dr. Michael Sala has done a very thorough job investigating the extraterrestrial phenomena, and we think it is very unfair that his involvement with the American University will eventually be terminated, and see what can happen. And meanwhile, let's move on to some other things here, if we can, Michael. And good luck to you on that one, by the
way.
Thank you. Appreciate that for you. The investigations of the various different races comes back again to where they are, how far their planet has advanced. Any idea what time periods we're talking about for them? I mean, are they hundreds of years advanced than us? Millions of years advanced? Obviously, they're more advanced than we are. I mean, the primitive type, they're not on spaceships. So how far advanced are these races?
Well, there's a range here. Apparently, the Umites, their technology is probably a few hundred years in advance of Earth, just in terms of the research that's available and their activities, whereas other races, such as those from the star system Sirius A, are much further ahead than that. We're probably talking thousands of years ahead. And then if you look at a race like the Andromedans, you might even say, well, that's even more advanced. So there's differences amongst the ETs that I don't think that all the ET races are at the same technological point, that they themselves have important differences. And they probably are just ranging from technologies that are, say, a few centuries ahead of ours to technologies that are many thousands of years.
And again, I want to get your website out one more time. I mean, the email address out for the president of American University. Some people have spelled his name wrong. Ladner at American.edu. Okay, simple enough as that. When you did your investigating into these various races, you mentioned the Anunnaki. Sitchin, of course, talks about 3,600-year orbit, as we talked about. But that's where all this Planet X discussion has come about, Nibiru. Are you convinced that that planet is out there and obviously coming back close to the planet Earth?
Well, I think that the Sitchin material has been received in such a way that it indicates that there is something that is going on. He's tapped into something that the response right across the spectrum from the kind of general public's response and also from the national security agencies. I have been told confidentially that Sitchin has been taken on board in terms of being given access to certain classified information, that he is taken very seriously by national security agencies and has also been silenced or told not to reveal certain information that might confirm his observations or his interpretations. So I think that there's a lot to suggest that Sitchin is accurate with his description of a world populated by the Anunnaki that returns to the vicinity of our solar system every 3,600 years.
Which also then tells me, Michael, that it's very possible that the Earthlings of the time may have confused extraterrestrial visitations and may have confused religious implications with extraterrestrial sightings.
Definitely, yes. The whole phenomenon of peoples developing religious belief systems would have been influenced by these ETs. And so we see, for example, in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis, where that famous passage in chapter 6 describes how the Nephilim basically took the daughters of humans, women, and basically procreated with them and created a new race. And so there, you, indeed there's evidence that there was some kind of interaction between the gods and humans, and also the way in which humans were created, the whole story of Adam and Eve, where you have the involvement of the Elohim and of the supreme deity. There again, you can read between the lines and say, well, here is evidence of a genetic experiment process involving these ETs and the production of a human race. So,
Michael, is it possible, though, you're being silenced?
I believe that I've gotten to the point where, yes, that is beginning to happen, and I do understand that the information that I'm now releasing is something that a lot of people within the shadow government don't want to be released. I mean, simply, they basically, as far as I can tell, want people to be kind of in a state of doubt, denial, or even fear about the ET presence. The last thing they want is people to start knowing that there are these very positive ET races out there wanting to interact with humanity, wanting to share their technologies and wanting to give hope and inspiration to humanity. That's not what they want the general public to know. So anyone who's divulging that information is silenced, and if someone like me has a position that gives them a certain amount of kind of public legitimacy, well, they can orchestrate events so that those sorts of people are kind of shifted out of those positions.
You know, and you could be wrong in your research, okay? I mean, that's always a possibility. But you know what? You shouldn't be silenced because you're going ahead to try to find out what the truth may or may not be. And I tell you what, I would love to be a fly in that guy's office tomorrow morning when he opens up his email and sees 50,000 emails sitting on his computer.
Well, that's an amazing thing, George, and thank you for that initiative. And I'm certain that if he did go into his office and sees the level of interest out there from the general public, that he'll think twice about what's happening. And, you know, there is a reputation here. The American University has a very liberal, progressive reputation, and do they want to be known as a university that censors scholars?
What was your current job going to be as a researcher? What were you working on? What specific project?
It was basically putting together a program that would help people to practice transformative peace techniques, kind of self-transformation using skills and knowledge based on a lot of the kind of alternative literature that means or that leads people to developing their own inner peace and making that the basis for transforming the society in which they live. So you have a kind of greater societal peace stemming out of the inner peace that individuals have developed.
Did you also teach students? Did you have classes?
No, this was purely a research and workshop-oriented position. I previously taught for 5 years as an assistant professor.
So why didn't they simply say, you know, Michael, we're going to stop this project, but we're going to move you into a different area now? I mean, you've got 8 years with us. You know, we love you. We're, you know, you're going to now teach this. They wouldn't even do that, would they?
No. Well, I think that the director of the program that I was putting together, he was probably intimidated by the topic. I think maybe he was someone that had been made aware at some point. In fact, he had been a former advisor on the Institute for Cooperation in Space, which is an organization that Carl Rosen and Alfred Weber have been involved in for a number of decades now, and he was a former advisor on that, and that certainly would at some point have brought to his attention this whole ET phenomenon, and I think he probably was advised about how to deal with that, and now I'm kind of
stuck in the
middle.
All right, stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines next hour with Dr. Michael Sala, and here's that email address one more time. Let him open them up in the morning and just flood him. LADNER@American.edu. Well, Michael, thousands of emails are going to the good American University president right now as we speak. I'm getting fast blasts, people either copying me or telling me what they've done. So it'll be very interesting tomorrow morning when you go into the office.
Yes, well, thank you. That'll really bring to his attention that there is a lot of public interest in this research, and hopefully he'll respond in a positive way.
Has your situation even gone up as high as him yet?
Yes, I have notified him. He has received a letter, and he has advised action by another administrator in the university to look into the matter.
Ah.
And so it's still in the midst of a process.
Still on the burner then, huh?
Yes.
Okay, let's go to the phones. You ready?
Yep.
A wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with Dr. Michael Sala. Hi there.
Is it George?
It sure is, sir.
Hey, this is Matt from Tulsa, 1170.
Right. Welcome to the program, Matt.
Amazing. I called 13 times the other night and got through, but the patching to get me through on the computer, I guess I got cut off every time, but I got through 13 times.
My, that's uncalled for, so to speak. All right. Go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, I've had a few UFO alien encounters, I guess you'd call them. First happened in Oregon, on the Mount Hood area. Me and my friend had taken a ride up to the top of the mountain, and we had these lights had come over our car, and it was like a ship moving, a circular disc moving without moving. I guess you could say no sound, no noise. And my friend, he said, don't look at it, don't look at it. So we were looking at the snow. I started seeing, like, all these hieroglyphic, I don't know if they were Mayan or Aztec, but all these symbols and letters. So it was real disturbing. I felt like, I don't know, something was, like, in my mind like telepathically doing something. So we went down. My stomach started hurting. We drove back down the mountain. And this is going to sound crazy. I mean, but it's totally true. My stomach started hurting real bad. So I went to the bathroom. And in the toilet where I went, there was this small reptilian creature.
No.
I called my friend. I said, come in here and look at this right now. So he came in there, and he'd seen it, and he said, no, close it, close it. My other friend came in, and he said, we can get money for that. And he was trying to grab it, and we were trying to get it. My other friend slammed the toilet.
Michael, have you ever heard of anything like this?
Well, there are supposed to be these small reptilian creatures in South America, the chupacabras that are supposed to be doing certain nasty things to wildlife there.
I mean, was this this was obviously in his body.
I missed that. So this was in his body, and it
and he was able to excrete it.
Oh, well, that is that, I haven't heard that before.
To be that alien.
Oh, well, that is something very unusual. I'm not sure how that would happen. I mean, you do have the hybrid phenomenon where a woman goes through the normal gestation period for 3 months, and then a hybrid is produced and removed by the ETs. But I've never heard something like that. That is very unusual.
Yeah, this is going to be a first on our archive list as well. Let's go to our first-time caller line. East, we'll try East of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Jesse. How you gentlemen doing this evening?
We're fine, Jesse. Thanks.
I had a quick question. A few months back, within the media, they claimed that they found a new planet entering our system. I assume that that's occurring. Could this possibly be Nibiru?
Now you're talking about Sedna, which they thought might have been an extra planet, and then they came back and said no. But what's your take on that, Michael?
Well, there have been lots of reports of a tenth planet that may be entering the solar system or that has been known. Robert Harrington in 1981 was, I believe, the first astronomer. He was at the U.S. Naval Astronomy Observatory, and he was able to do some of the calculations for this planet. And since that time, there have been reports of planet entering into the solar system, or it being known that it was heading our way. And I believe Sedna was possibly some planetoid associated with that, but I mean the reports are still very, very hazy. But there's a lot happening there, and we're not being told the full story. But I do know that Zachariah Sitchin did actually have an interview with Robert Harrington. This is before Harrington died in New Zealand, and basically was able to confirm that yes, the object that Harrington was able to observe and mathematically calculate was very similar to the Nibiru that the Sumerians described.
You talk about the military, industrial, and extraterrestrial complex, adding an extra phrase to Eisenhower's sole statement. How come?
Well, because I believe that it's become so intertwined now that the military-industrial complex has become so so connected with various ET races that are part of these agreements, that there have been joint projects that various elites, whether in the national security agencies or whether the corporations, have been influenced by ETs. So I think that the whole thing has become a very extensive network.
Are you totally convinced, Michael, that the governments are in cahoots with these extraterrestrials?
Yes. I think there's no doubt once one looks through the evidence in a kind of very objective and methodical way, when you look at the systematic reports by the whistleblowers and the contactees about the various situations involving ETs and government collaboration or government suppression of ET knowledge, that there is a very extensive infrastructure set up to deal with ETs, and that much of this involves cooperation with ETs.
Getting back again to the 57 various varieties, almost like a Heinz 57, very strange number indeed, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I don't know how that number came up. Clifford Stone came up with that number of ET races. There have been others. I believe John Lear mentioned over 60, and so there have been other estimates, but that was one that Clifford Stone came up with.
What do you think of Lear and his implant operations?
Well, I'm not sure of the implant operations that he may have been discussing. I'm aware of some of his work, and it seems to be pretty consistent with a lot of the testimonies that various whistleblowers and contactees have released. So I think a lot of it is based on solid information.
Next up, let's go to first time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hey, good evening, George.
Good evening to you too. Thanks.
Thanks. I've been trying the evening to get through to you guys, and finally I have. And I was so surprised when came onto the phone. Thanks. Mr. Salas, I have a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
Yep.
You were talking about genetics as to that we somehow were intertwined with the alien races. Yes or no?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Then how does that go back to our genetic trace back to the primates of us here on planet Earth?
Well, what appears to be the way in which this happens is that ETs will visit a primitive planet, and genetically upgrade species that are indigenous to the planet, upgrade them so that they start to display superior intelligence and advanced abilities that we might think of as psychic abilities, so that they can develop technologies. And through a number of these interventions and these genetic upgrades, eventually you have what we would consider to be modern humanity. And so this seems to be a process that a number of ET races have been involved with. I did mention very briefly that the contactee Alex Collier described 22 different ET races that have intervened at various points of human history to do these kinds of genetic upgrades.
Okay, then where does that not come in our DNA genetic structure? Why don't we see the difference in that?
I'm not sure what you mean by why don't we see the difference in that.
Because we follow it, trace it right back to our primate ancestors. Then where is the difference? Where's the outside RNA or something that comes out there that would be there? Where's the missing link in the DNA structure?
Well, that's work that Lloyd Pye has been looking at. He's been describing this missing link, this missing genetic link, and he believes that it's evidence of an ET intervention. So Lloyd Pye has a website. I don't have the details at the moment, but you could just do a Google search on Lloyd Pye.
I think it might be just LloydPye.com, as a matter of fact.
Right, yes. And so he's done a lot of work on this missing link, and you'll find that he gives you a lot of information as to why this missing link is a result of a genetic intervention, a genetic modification by ETs.
Do you believe that any hybrid children are being raised on this planet now, kind of like put into society?
Yes, I do believe that the genetic experiments that a particular group of ETs known as the Greys have been doing has resulted in some hybrids being feasible enough to be able to be introduced into the human population. We don't know how many, but certainly I believe that this is really the goal that this whole hybrid program is aiming at, to be able to produce a sustainable and durable hybrid that can be introduced into the mainstream of human society and possibly become a dominant aspect of human society over a number of decades.
Next up, Wildcard Line, your turn. You're on with Michael Sala. Hi there.
Hello. Hi, George. Got through, first time caller, long time listener.
Well, welcome to the show.
First, I basically was wondering, I've heard a lot of predictions, you know, that the ETs are going to make a public appearance and be known to everybody, you know, in the near future. And I was just curious, you know, what his thoughts was on that. Is there any evidence to support it? Maybe.
Michael, have you heard that?
Well, yes. Everyone has a different take on when this might happen. I believe that we probably have a phenomenon where those controlling the whole ET project are divided on this particular issue. Some want to continue to withhold information for a variety of reasons, basically not wanting to disclose the full extent of the projects that are being conducted now. And there are others within the system who want to release this information. So I believe what you have is this kind of very strange situation where a lot of information is being leaked. Whistleblowers are coming forward, releasing their statements. A lot of documents are being leaked, the Majestic documents. While at the same time you have the mainstream media basically distancing themselves or not touching this particular area, and that's reflecting that aspect of the ET management system that wants to keep this whole thing out of the public arena.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Okay, appreciate it. By the way, and again, a number of you fast-blasting, Lex will post right after the show in the synopsis of tonight's program the email address of the president of American University, and I assume it's a Dr. Ladner is his probably title, but the email address is ladner@american.edu. And again, be very polite about it. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Oh, hi, George. I'm calling from St. Louis.
Well, hi there.
Hi. I'm calling KTRS.
Sure thing.
I just want to say hi to everyone out there, and thanks to Michael for his wonderful research. And I had a question and a comment. Michael, I was wondering if you're familiar with the research done on earthbound extraterrestrials, humans with extraterrestrial souls.
Okay, humans with extraterrestrial souls. That's the starseeds. Brad Steiger has a book on that where he discusses that kind of starseed phenomena.
Uh-huh.
And so that's probably a good place to start. Then there are also humans that are basically described to be an offshoot of ancient human civilizations that have extensive ET connections, and they are supposed to inhabit certain locations on the planet, one being Mount Shasta, and the race that's supposed to exist under Mount Shasta are described as the Telosians. And Bill Hamilton has actually done some interviews with people who he believes may have been from this civilization. So that information is also available.
Okay. Do you have any estimates on the percentage, possibly, of the modern human population that might be of a hybrid nature?
Wow, that's a difficult one. We've got hybrids, we've got star seeds, and then we've got ETs who may be mixed up with the population as well. That would probably be the smallest percentage. But I don't know what the estimates are for star seeds and hybrids, but I do know that the number of abductees are around the 3% mark.
And that's a lot of people.
That's right.
6 billion people on the planet, so you're talking about 180 million people. That's a lot of people.
Well, that's right. If that 3% figure is consistent around the planet, then, yeah, we'd have quite a lot.
Why hybrid people? Why do that?
Well, they're probably manipulating human genetics to see how humans express their emotions. I believe that the greys who do this type of work are very interested in human emotions such as love and hatred. They're very interested to see how those emotions are expressed in their various forms, especially in the extreme, and so they tinker around with human genetics and develop a better understanding of this, because I think that this is really central to their main goal of developing a hardy hybrid species that can be the new human model.
All right, we'll come back. We'll continue to take phone calls. Also want to ask you if there are any private citizen groups, not governments now, that are working with some of these ETs. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Michael Sala, these are his theories. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, of these 57 extraterrestrial races, are any of them on the, like, the silicon-type extraterrestrials with that kind of organic structure to it?
Well, it seems that some of these ET races have a kind of body that might have a mixture of different components, the carbon and then the silicon. But then there's also descriptions of ETs with light bodies, where the basic molecules are photons. So it would be a number of combinations, and I think some of the ET races that might come from some kind of interdimensional location may exhibit these kinds of light bodies. But certainly I think the kind of silicon versus carbon-based ET races that would also be very relevant here.
Let's go back to the phones. East of the Rockies, you're on with Michael Sala. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing, George?
Fine, thank you.
I just wanted to ask Michael, we go to Louisiana like three times a year canoeing, and we hear rumors that that's where like the reptilian race is being raised, is out in the swamp. They said it's like the perfect environment, and I've never seen it firsthand, but there's a lot of people out there that talk about it.
Well, I don't know about Louisiana, but I do know that there are a number of descriptions of ETs being, the reptilians being witnessed, and that that they do inhabit these subterranean areas, and certainly one needs to be very careful in visiting these areas. I do recall reading that in the case of South Africa, that there are certain areas where it becomes very dangerous to travel.
Well, it does give me the creeps when I'm out there sometimes, because, like, we stay out there kind of late, and when the sun starts going down, you know, they say, unless you're really experienced, don't stay out there. And you can almost feel like, you know, I know there's a lot of animals out there watching you, but it's also like something else is watching you.
Well, yes, certainly, if you have to follow your feelings and if you feel very uncomfortable in an area, well, that's probably a clue that that might not be very, very safe.
Yeah, once the sun goes down, we definitely go back to the camp.
Don't blame you. Thanks for the call.
All right, bye-bye.
Appreciate it. What about reports of Bigfoot being extraterrestrial? Do you get any reports that of these 57 races, they could look like that?
Well, yes, there have been these reports of a creature, Bigfoot, that accompanies some of these sightings. I was just reading Timothy Good's latest book on alien contact, where he does talk about Bigfoot being associated with some of these visitations. So people will see an ET craft in the area, and also then they'll notice a Bigfoot type creature. So there seems to be something going on there. I really haven't done that much research on the Bigfoot phenomena. Not sure exactly how they fit into this typology. But they may be an indigenous species that possibly an offshoot of an earlier kind of genetic experiment that didn't produce a sustainable species, but it continues to live.
Wildcard line, it's your turn. Hi there.
Go Hello.
Ahead. Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Oh, yes, Joe Tucker from, excuse me.
That's all right.
Detroit area.
All right, Joe, go ahead.
CKLW 800. Yes, George and Mike, I wanted to ask you about, there was Phil Snyder had came up with a lot of information, published a lot of stuff on the Internet some years back, 90s, 94, so forth, and he had talked about the politics that related to the different kinds of aliens, the Syrian-based humanoids and the Regalian-based reptilians, trying to pull these together into what they called a Asturian Aldebaran collective in a new galactic order. And there were a lot of other aliens he talked about. Of course, you know, Phil was involved in the Dulce, New Mexico attack thing.
Right.
But I just thought Mike would talk about the politics just a little bit there, if he could.
Sure. Well, I know Phil Snyder discussed the Tall Greys. They were a race that he observed were part of this New World Order that presumably was being prepared for secretly, and that he participated in building a base with a kind of legislative room that was modeled on a UN-type architecture where the Tall Greys would play a role in that. As far as the Syrian and the reptilian connection is concerned, I don't recall reading Phil's discussion of that, but I know that others such as Al Bielak and those involved in the Montauk Project, Preston Nichols, for example, they talked about those from Sirius B and the reptilians as being in a close cooperation, which is part of my research. So you'll see there I've included the Sirius B humans and the reptilians as part of this network that works with the military intelligence community.
I believe that the Dogon tribe, they were given information a long time ago from those extraterrestrials from the Sirian star cluster. What do you think those extraterrestrials look like, Michael?
Well, the Dogons described them as coming from the smaller of the two Sirius stars. So the Dogons described them as coming from Sirius B and described them as being amphibians, basically being something like we would consider, say, a dolphin, a kind of humanoid dolphin-type race. And interestingly, in the work of Alex Collier, he described Sirius B as being a star system where you have reptilian and amphibian races being predominant, as well as some human races. So it seems that the Sirius B star does have a very interesting mix of planets with these different races, and the Dogons were visited by one of these races.
There are reports that something crashed into the mountains in Wales a few days ago. Could have been a meteorite, huge explosion. Some people say it was an unidentified flying object. Did you hear about that, Michael?
No, I didn't hear about that Wales incident, but any UFO that does crash, that area is dealt with by the teams that are designed to sanitize an area of ET presence, and there's a very interesting document, the Special Operations Manual that was released in the Majestic documents that detailed how these elite organizations would go into an area and seal it off and remove the, mm-hmm. the information. So that's the 1954 document that people can read online. So it gives you an idea of what might be happening in places like Wales if there is a UFO crash.
Let's go west of the Rockies. It's your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
We are well, thanks.
My question is, what are your thoughts on, like, the supernatural world? Because, like, our technology, we're just now getting into the beginnings of EVP, and someone, like, way, way advanced than us would obviously have gotten there, contacted, you know, the other side. So is there any, like, cases where someone sees someone that's dead on a UFO that has passed on?
Well, as far as the supernatural is concerned and UFOs, I mean, my approach is to really just look at the testimonies of people, and if our, you know, whistleblowers, contactees, abductees, whoever, and look at their testimonies and just see how consistent and coherent they are. And if they describe these supernatural abilities of ETs and or of humans or hybrids, well, then I think we need to look at that closely. And certainly I think there's a lot of evidence that what we would consider to be supernatural in terms of these enhanced psychic abilities or interdimensional travel capabilities, that all of this really needs to be treated very seriously, because there's a lot of credible people out there that claim to have been involved in projects where these abilities have been demonstrated.
Steve writes from Alberta, Canada, if you want a little levity here, 57 varieties of aliens, Heinz 57. Carrie's married to a Heinz. That means she or he may be alien. You're not laughing, Michael.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting that's an interesting thought. Wow, it's, the Heinz connection. Wow.
First time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Oh yes, this is Mike Harper down here in Tampa.
Hi, Mike.
I was wondering if Dr. Sala knew about the. I think they took a skin graph off of. An alien on Area 51 down five stories down. He can't seem to breathe this kind of air, if he knows anything about that. I think I heard that on your show, George, or maybe with Art Bell the other night.
Yeah, Art had that. You've heard reports, Michael, of those kinds of things being done to extraterrestrial bodies, haven't you?
Yes, well, I know that that was something that Dan Burrish claimed that he was originally charged to do in terms of dealing with one of the ETs, a J-Rod, looked like a
right,
gray.
Right.
And he, one of his jobs was to perform these skin grafts and examine the tissue structure of the ET. That was a live ET. Now, it seems that Mike from Tampa is talking about skin grafts that might come from dead ETs recovered from craft. So I'm certain that would have happened. But definitely there's been a lot of kind of exobiological work done on captive ETs or captured ETs or dead ETs, so I'm sure that there's a lot of knowledge on the ET physiology.
Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
It is fine, thanks.
This is Avery from Pocatello, Idaho.
Hi, Avery.
And I was wondering about the Dulce you guys were talking about. Is there's a Dulce in northern New Mexico, but it's like a little town. Is that affiliated with the Dulce you guys are talking about?
Sure is, I think.
Yes,
oh, really?
That's the place. Just by the, there's a an Indian reservation there, the Jacarilla Reservation.
The Jicarilla, yeah.
So that is the area, and it borders the Nevada region, and there's an underground shuttle that connects Dulce with S4 and Area 51 there.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because, you know, there's been activity down there. I used to kind of live up around that place too, and it's pretty crazy, you know, a little bit of UFO, and like you're talking about, the Bigfoot connection somehow is going to be happening like that, I guess, but... Thanks a lot. I was just wondering about that.
Yeah, that's the place. Okay, thank you. Appreciate
it.
Have you ever been down to that region, Michael?
No, not yet. It's certainly one of those areas that I would like to visit eventually. But at the moment, I'm concentrating on getting as much many of these contactee testimonies as I can, because I think there's a lot of information there, and I'm approaching a number of contactees and doing interviews and putting that information together.
East of the Rockies, it's your turn. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, George. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
I'm surprised you didn't ask this of Michael with your curious mind, but I wanted to ask Michael if he had any information on our guests and how they feel about one creator, and by them tampering with our DNA, are they bringing us closer to the one that we believe created us, or are they pulling us away?
All right. Well, and I didn't ask him because I was waiting for you to do that.
Oh, well, thank you.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, what is the connection between religion and ETs? I think that the religion or approach that the ETs have in terms of these... questions of spirituality is probably very different to what we would consider to be an approach that we recognize. I don't believe that there is this emphasis on an all-powerful kind of anthropomorphic creator that we find in most religions on Earth, that the ETs, and here I'm relying on the testimonies of those that have spoken to contactees like Billy Meyer, that the ETs have a belief in a source that pervades all existence, and that this source unites all life, and that as beings concentrate their energies and focus on this source connecting all life, that that's where the ultimate kind of self-awareness comes out of. So we don't have this appearance of a divine being or creator, but a source, a kind of non-anthropomorphic source that pervades all life.
You believe in the Billy Meyer case?
I think that the evidence that he has in terms of photos, in terms of film, and the investigations that people like Wendell Stevens conducted, also Gary Kinder's book, Light Years, I mean, this evidence and the investigations they conducted were very thorough, and I think that in the end that it's a very credible contact.
Maybe time for one more quick call. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Phil. I'm calling from Joplin, Missouri.
Hi, Phil.
Quick question. I was just wondering, so how do these ETs go out? I mean, do they just randomly pick up the first guy they see? I mean, they have to have some kind of idea what they're looking for.
Good question. Why do they pick the person they pick, Michael?
Well, you know, here we need to distinguish between the abductees and the contactees. It appears that the abductees are picked out because of some kind of genetic disposition that they have, or some genetic makeup that is of interest to the greys, predominantly, who pick them up. As far as the contactees are concerned, it appears that they are contacted on the basis of their telepathic ability. In other words, people who have some kind of telepathic ability might find themselves in a situation where they, with a human who is in fact an ET, but is kind of integrating himself or herself in human society. There are a lot of ETs that are sufficiently humanoid looking that they just fit in, and they interact with people who have a kind of a telepathic ability.
Our website for Michael Sala is exoexopolitics.org. His book is called Exopolitics as well. Michael, where can you get the book?
You can get it at any bookstore now. It can be ordered through the bookstores, or it can be ordered online.
All right. Keep in touch with us, Michael. Let us know how that email campaign went, okay?
I definitely will. And thanks for your help in that and having me on the show again.
Always, always. For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean La Desor, the three L's of the company, Barbara Simpson and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next.